Welcome back to a little thing we like to call the counter position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go, kids. Episode 146. What are we going to call this episode? This is the tax day episode. Oh, man. Yeah, so, since last we spoke, so I try to get my taxes done this weekend, right? As a good chunk of America probably is. And I lost my primary 1099. And I knew that I had put it in my inbox, but my inbox had gotten, so I have like this giant backlog of stuff that needs to be processed and put into files and in my system. And I usually use a system called Getting Things Done by David Allen, and I have gotten completely off the bandwagon. So I had tried to get back on the bandwagon, and I guess I must have emptied my small inbox into the big backlog inbox, and somehow my 1099 got in there. So I had the proverbial needle in the proverbial haystack. So could you imagine, just, I mean, wow, talk about frustrating stuff. So everything that I didn't want to deal with, or that was not bleeding at the moment, has just kind of been piling up, right? And I process, you know, anything that's important and needs to be done like right now, it's like, yeah, okay. Then it's stuff you don't want to deal with. You're like, oh yeah, throw that over there. Okay, that's starting to pile up. Put it in that box and set it off to the side, and I'm going to take a weekend and get all this caught up. And I've attempted it a couple times and it hasn't happened. And so I've just got all, so the one thing you need is this 1099. And you don't even really want to be doing your taxes, but you've put it off and it has to happen now, right? So this is the weekend. It has to happen. And it's the only way to get to the mission critical piece that you need, that you have to have, or things will be ugly, is to go through all of the stuff that you have not wanted to deal with and you have ignored for the last few years. Man, I tell you what, if that's not a symbol for the spiritual life, I don't know what is, man. I'm telling you. Oh, goodness gracious. It's but I did it. I didn't get all the way through. I only went as far through my I got about a fourth of the way through my backlog. I knew it had to be on top there somewhere. I got a ton of stuff filed. I started working on getting back on to the Getting Things Done bandwagon. So I want to talk about that a little bit today. And I found my 1099. So I can't remember last night. I made it put out a plea for prayer for my 1099. And so if I did, I don't remember if I did or not. I should have. If I didn't, or if I did and you prayed for me, then thank you. Because it worked. And I found my 1099. And I came out and escaped. Man, I was so stressed though, going through all that. So so it's, you know, over the weekend, just kind of like seeing that and working with that, I'm like, okay, you know what, got to get back on the organized bandwagon, you know. And I think I've done a show about getting things done before. I should do a complete show. If I haven't, let me go back and see. I intended to at some point, like to interview David Allen at some point, which I could get done over Skype, but no reason I can't. We're friends. So anyway, so Getting Things Done is a system invented by, or compiled by, David Allen. And it basically has to do with, like, you know, in short, you know, if I ask you, hey, are you worried about where you need to be on the third Tuesday of October? And you're like, no, it has not occurred to me. I'm like, well, maybe there's something important. Well, there might be, but, well, why aren't you worried about it? Well, I have a calendar. If there's something important that far out, I have it marked down. And it's like, oh, so you have a tool where these outcomes that need to happen for you that are time sensitive and location sensitive are out of your head and in a system that you review on a regular basis. And so that doesn't really have a piece of you. You're like, yeah. Okay, what about the other 99% of things that you want to have happen in this world that you want to make different than they are that don't happen at a particular time and place? Exactly. So what getting things done is the calendar for all those other outcomes. And he has you basically just identify every possible outcome that you have in your head, empty it out, identify any kind of projects, and for him, anything with two or more actions is a project, and then you figure out what is the next action, the next physical thing that if the only thing you had to do on planet Earth was to get this project done, what would I see you do? And then you log that into a system based around context. So calls, errands, these different things, email, online, different things. And so, and then you review that all once a week. Once a week, you look over your 72 projects, your 137 next actions, your, you know, all of your someday maybes and your all that stuff. You look over all of it. You look over your calendar for the last week, see if you missed anything, any kind of open loops. If you come home from a meeting, you throw your notes into your inbox and then you process that. And every time you get a piece of paper out of your inbox or a voicemail or anything, you say, what is this? Does this require any action from me? If yes, is that part of a larger outcome that more than one action will be part of? Okay, so you look at this action, you go, okay, is this for me to do? And if you say no, then you're going to delegate it, right? But if it needs to happen, but you're not the one to do it, then you're going to have to delegate it or something. How are you going to track that? And if it doesn't have any action attached to it, you go, well, is this you know, trash? Is it reference? Like, I want to keep this around? Or is this some notes from a meeting? I'd like to look back over them before the next time we talk about this, you know? Anyway, so when you do that, your head gets empty and you're actually present. And it's interesting. Hanging out with David Allen that wrote that book, Getting Things Done, which I cannot recommend enough. It's almost unsettling because you're not used to having everyone's undivided attention. And I tell you what, since I hung out with David, it's probably even more unsettling because since then I've gotten used to everyone having their phone out all the time. And David is sitting there looking at you, listening to everything you say, and he's there. He's actually present. And it's kind of strange. You're not used to having 100% of someone. You're not used to having someone 100% in the moment, and the moment that they're in is what you're saying. It's almost like it kind of bears a little bit of responsibility, you know? It reminds me of, you know, when I was going to Thomas Aquinas College, it was a great book school, and in a great book school, there are no lectures, and there are no textbooks. Well, there's a Latin textbook, but you have to... you bring the teacher, they don't call them professors because they're not professing anything. They call them tutors because they are just students further along the path. And you read this work together and they primarily ask questions. So you are responsible to bring the content of the class with you from your reading of the text as a group. And so if you don't, nothing happens. Well, it's kind of like that in the sense of like, with David, it's like I got used to where I would say, hey, you know, and I would call him up or I would stop him in the hall when I was delivering coffee and say hi to him. And I started realizing, like, oh, I really need to have something, you know, to say to the man. I need to be kind of in a place where I can be present because this person's going to give me everything in the moment, even for that 30 seconds or something. It kind of impresses on you. And I got to thinking, it's like, you know, what if we all acted like that, you know? So anyway, I am, after I finish my taxes, I am going to climb back onto the bandwagon over the weekend. And so I've got some thoughts about kind of outcomes and how to get to those outcomes and some productivity and ideas. And we might get to that today. That's what I kind of have for the last segment or so. I want to talk about that, those kind of things in light of a book on working out and exercise that I've been reading and a Tim Ferriss concept called Most Minimum Effective Dose. Or it's not Tim Ferriss's concept, but I heard about it from Tim Ferriss. So, yeah, so that's where we're going to go later, I think. Yeah, so hey, we're under the snow gun here in Denver, Colorado. It was deep in the high 70s, almost, it was 81 in my car at one point, it said, yesterday, and we got a big fat winter storm warning, and there's a slow moving, very wet storm on its way, and they've updated the forecasts, and it looks like it has a good chance of just parking right for a while. So they're predicting we're going to get, you know, about 14 inches of snow, but it's going to be that heavy, wet spring snow. And so it'll probably collapse down to about 8, but we're going to get dumped on over the weekend, like starting in the middle of the night tonight. So the plan is to finish the show and then run up to Trader Joe's and buy everything that I'm going to need for the weekend so I don't have to leave unless I absolutely have to. Maybe stop and get a few bottles of wine for the crew here. And yeah, then we're going to hunker down. And I plan to make some soup. I've got a couple of lamb bones in the freezer, and I think I'm going to get another chunk of that grass-fed lamb that they have for such a good price at Safeway right now, and I'm going to make some stock and maybe make like some lamb stew. Can't go wrong with something hearty like lamb stew with garlic and rosemary and stuff for a cold day. So that's the plan there. Let's go to the break, and when we get back, got a couple more things I want to talk about, and then we'll get into the concept of minimum effective dose. You're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. Thanks for coming out.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so I just want to share this. So I went to Thump Coffee up on 13th and Downing today, a place that I go to hunker down at a table in the corner, drink refills of batch brew, and write or work on something. And I was just kind of reading and working on some stuff, writing in some thoughts down in a notebook, and some stuff that I'm going to applying to my life, some of the stuff that I'm going to talk to you guys about later in the show, and just kind of working out some ideas. And I was sitting next to these two women. You know, one looked to be like in her very early 20s, the other one probably late 20s, early 30s. And as best I could understand, the younger one was an herbalist consultant, an herbal consultant, like an herbalist. And the woman was meeting with her. And I mean to tell you, I have been hanging out in coffee houses since the late 80s. Late 89, I think. I have lived in Columbia, Missouri, the Berkeley of the Midwest. And just at a point in time when that town was run by the hippies. Okay, I have been around. I have lived in California. I have worked and hung out and almost lived in Ojai, California, the highest, the place on earth with the most registered non-traditional religions as its headquarters. You know, basically, there's more cults on planet Earth with their home address in Ojai. In fact, if you're a good solid cult and you want to be respected, you need to have a post office box in Ojai, California. This is a town where I think around Halloween in certain times of year, you can't even adopt a pet because there were people like doing animal sacrifice and stuff, right? Okay, so I've been around. I've lived in California, okay? I've hung out in pretty crunchy places. I heard the single most like crunchy new age conversation I have ever heard in my entire life. I mean, just the presuppositions and just the agreement that didn't need to be defended. And just, I mean, I was just, oh my gosh. Wow. I don't even want to go into it. It was just like, I've already been chastised by my Facebook friends for not live tweeting it, but it was, Man, we're talking chakras and Reiki and herbalism and meat being toxic. And I mean, just, oh God, energetic self. And I mean, just, they were just talking as if they were just talking about like the weather, just these, just very matter of fact, the single weirdest, craziest, like, new age things that I have ever heard in my life. I was just like, and I'm a pretty open-minded guy, pretty open-minded dude, but yeah, that was pretty interesting. So to fix that, I just felt dirty after that, and so I needed, and I was hungry, so I got a steak sandwich for lunch, you know, because every time you eat, as Patton Oswalt has told us, and I think it's true, every time you bite into a steak, a hippie loses his hacky sack. And so I was like, I need to cleanse myself from all this tofunic energy. There's just energetic tofu all over me. I smelled like patchouli. Wow. It was epic. So I, I went and got a steak sandwich. I've been hearing about Vert Kitchen on South Pearl and how amazing it is. So I went and got, just a beautiful steak, flank steak sandwich on a baguette with some, arugula and like kind of a, what was it? A walnut oil, mustard dressing. Wow. So good. Such real, just a few flavors, but so delicious. Really, really incredible sandwich. You know, I've been hearing a lot about Vert. It's just a little neighborhood, really small hole in the wall. So if you live, in kind of the central part of Denver here, right there, not too far from Whole Foods on Washington and 25, Vert. And I went next door. They have taken over the old space that used to be La Belle Rosette, and is a little tiny space. And they've taken it over and turned it into Overt, which is a little small coffee bar, right? And wow, it's a really cool layout. There's a few things I would change, but it's really, really nice people. Had a good conversation with them. They had a really great selection of like little grab and go stuff and everything made by the commissary kitchen next door. And, it was an old alleyway, they said. That's why it was such a long, skinny space. Someone enclosed the alleyway and it was brick walls. And, they had basically a counter running down one side. There's not really any seating. There's just like a standing, shelf to set your drink on. They're going to put some seating out back, looks like, and there'll probably be some sidewalk seating. But it's a big long hallway kind of a thing, and there's just a counter running along the side, and all the equipment's on there. So if you're going to the bathroom or you go back to the back seating, you're walking back and forth. You're basically behind the counter. There is no behind the counter. And I was fascinated by that concept because I'm always using under counter stuff or different kinds of methods to lay out a coffee bar to kind of limit the separation between the barista and the customer for the sake of relationship and them being able to really observe craft. And in this layout, customers would be basically behind the bar working with you, like watching you work in the same way that you watch yourself work. Like if you're training someone, which I don't know what I think about that. I'm intrigued. I've already got a couple of innovative layout possibilities in my head. So if you hear me in the next 6 months to a year talking about this new bar I'm designing for someone, and it's, you know, double-sided and there is no behind the bar and everyone is kind of sitting behind the bar and they're all kind of taking part in everything as an experience, you'll know, you can say, oh, I heard it first. I remember the day that he came up with that idea. I've actually seen that. There's a coffee and tea and spice place or something on Upper State in Santa Barbara that had something kind of like that, but it was really awkward and not laid out well. So I don't know. Anyway, this is the counter position. So this is my take on the world from behind the counter. So if you're first time listening, I design coffee bars for a living. So and run coffee houses for a living. So I sometimes you get my not so interesting thoughts about a review on a place or an interesting layout that I saw. Anyway, both Vert and Overt, really great examples of what you can do with a really small space and do really high quality in a very small space. Really stoked on it. I've been wanting to build a tiny coffee house for a long time. And maybe maybe my next project that I own, making this a tiny, tiny shop. This a little grab and go kind of a few seats for the regulars along a bar or something. And I'm starting to get that itch again to build a real tiny bar somewhere. I might start looking for a micro space somewhere in this part of Denver just for grins. The last thing, something that I've talked about it before. And I'm just kind of coincidence threw me some stuff and I saw a pattern about some ideas and I really want to start looking into this. So I put that author Brooks TED talk up, where he was talking about, conservatives and liberals needing to work together and him making the claim that, It is capitalism. It is globalization, free markets, the rule of law, the encouragement of entrepreneurship and rewarding excellence in the market, and one other thing, I guess the crushing of corruption on the local level, which would be the rule of law. I don't know. There maybe was one more thing I have to go look and see. And he attributes that to pulling 2 billion people out of poverty. Now, what's interesting is Bernie Sanders is going to go speak at a conference, an economic conference for the anniversary of Centesimus Annus, the social encyclical. And John Paul II, that John Paul II wrote, and so, which was on the anniversary of Rerum Novarum. So Rerum Novarum was the first great social encyclical, and pretty much every 10 years, a pope has written, on the 10th, on the 20th, every 10 years they write on the anniversary of Centesimus Annus, or Rerum Novarum. Centesimus Annus was one of those. And now there's a conference talking about this, and now we have, of course, Laudato Si kind of addressed a lot of those same issues, the last encyclical by Pope Francis, right? And so Bernie Sanders, the guy running for president here in America, is going to speak over there, And so he set out his prepared remarks on the internet, and author Sebastian Rossman over at Cosmos and the Lost wrote a little article about it, and just praised Sanders' remarks up and down as being incredibly like a love letter to Catholicism and Catholic social doctrine. So I kind of looked it over and I listened to some a little talk that was kind of linked on that page. And it brought some I got some ideas. I'm starting to see some stuff. Oh, and then also I read a write-up on the new George Gilder book that's coming out. This has got me thinking. So we're going to explore this a little bit when we get back. So let's head to the break and we'll pick this up on the other side. You're listening to The Counter.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. So, when we went to the break, I was talking about, so I did that author, I talked about that author Brooks TED talk, and I want to go more deeply into that. And then I was just reading about the new book by George Gilder, which is called, I have it open, do I not? Yes. The Scandal of Money, Why Wall Street Recovers But the Economy Never Does. And this seems to be a lot of the things, at least in the article that I read, where what things that Gilder, who's a giant promoter of the true kind of real version of capitalism, he wrote Wealth and Poverty, which was the tome of supply side economics. It was Reagan bought it and gave it to everybody on his cabinet and had everybody read it. It was he is the guru of supply side. Now he's also the guru of defending entrepreneurship and the free market from the accusation of greed by Adam Smith and the Invisible Hand and all that. So it's interesting. He really does make an argument, and he's just released a new updated version of Wealth and Poverty. So I'm starting to think I'm going to try to drag David Quackenbush, one of my old mentor from Thomas Aquinas College, who's a giant Gilder fan. And I think he's friends with Gilder, and maybe I should just try to get Gilder on. That would be great. So I just like that he seems to be saying a lot of the stuff about bankers and fat cats and the game being rigged, and he wants to go back to the gold standard, looks like, which I think I'm a pretty big fan of money. I'm not a big giant fan of the Fed and fiat currency and all that. Call me Ron Paul, but that's kind of I kind of agree with him on that. But so what I, that's no, and I've known all that, but then I start seeing some of the same stuff coming out of Bernie Sanders, and you know, it's just, I'm seeing that, and I'm seeing Gilder, and I'm seeing Arthur Brooks, and I'm seeing a lot of people talking about a lot of the same stuff, but making different presuppositions and coming to different conclusions and wanting to look at different metrics. And so Bernie Sanders in this article that Rossman is praising as being the biggest love letter to Catholic social doctrine ever written, and really showing a beautiful, real, serious knowledge of Catholic social teaching. He makes the argument that poverty, since the writing of Sententiam Sanus, has gotten worse. And Arthur Brooks makes the argument that that poverty has gotten better, and then makes the claim that it is, in fact, those five things that are the key kind of conservative kind of boilerplates for the economy, that they're the things that have pulled 2 billion people out of poverty. Now, what's interesting is that Sanders shows us his evidence that, you know, this 1% versus this 99%. And he says that there are 60 richest people on earth own more than the bottom 3.5 billion. And he seems to think that kind of discrepancy is evidence that the poverty has gotten worse. And then Arthur Brooks is saying that no, there's 2 billion people that used to be in deep poverty that are not in poverty anymore. And it's interesting. I've said this before, I'm starting to think that Catholic social doctrine and maybe some of the theories around distributism with Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc and even Dorothy Day, there's a good example. You look at Chesterton and Belloc, definitely not what you would call liberals in the church, and Dorothy Day, former communist that founded the Catholic Worker Movement, in some ways people, I think she's been painted way more liberal than she actually was. She was fairly theologically conservative, and wasn't quite the friend of kind of Marxist theory that people have made her out to be, but they had almost identical views on economy, and both of them could be described roughly as distributism, which is kind of an emphasis on small business, independent business, each person kind of having a little part of reality that they can kind of sculpt in their own image, and kind of an emphasis on the small, kind of like, what was that E.F. Schumacher wrote, small is beautiful, something along those lines. So I don't know, I think that I keep seeing that there's a movement towards the common good, people wanting to turn away from this vast corporate greed and move to the common good. Start thinking seriously about the common good again, but they think the common good has to be served by the federal government. The other side says the common good has to be completely voluntary and at best kind of governed by the very, very local government. So you have the libertarian, like, just basically telling the federal government and most large government to keep the roads clear, deliver the mail, protect the border, and not much else. And then you've got this kind of, you know, pessimistic view of anything other than government on the left that says, no, we have to force people to do the right thing by the rule of law at the largest level so that the poor don't get trampled upon. And I think it's interesting, who'd have thought it, but I think that a real concern for the poor and a real concern for both solidarity and subsidiarity and a real serious dedication to talking about what actually works, what actually makes people's lives better, what results in a living wage or a living amount of money coming in the door for someone. This might, Catholic social doctrine and the different views and thoughts, everything from medieval guilds and all that up to distributism, might be a place that that is objective enough and halfway between, some, you know, just different enough from the presuppositions of all these people that it might play a role. And so I don't know. I don't know what to do about it, but I don't know much about all this stuff. It's just not in my wheelhouse. But the more I get interested, the more I think, I don't know, I might start reading more economic theory. Because really, that's kind of where the rubber meets the road on how big ideas affect the common man, is in the shape of our governments, political theory, and economic theory, right? So, I'm saying it once again, this theme that I've been playing with, that I've been kind of seeing as an emerging kind of intriguing possibility, is that I think that Catholic social doctrine can maybe play this central role where we can kind of comment on it, look at it, use it as kind of a guide, and maybe we can get enough agreement to where we could actually find some real serious common ground between some people that disagree on a lot of stuff, and both sides might be able to get a lot of what they want by seeing that the other side maybe has a better idea about that, or been teaching in charity the person on the other side that maybe they have the better idea about that. But I don't know. I don't know if any of us have enough of a lack of humility, enough humility to pull that off. But anyway, that's a very, very unformed thought, I admit. But I just start, you know, somebody who's really smart, go watch the author Brooks TED Talk, and then go read two or three Gilder books, and read that Bernie Sanders thing, and read some Catholic social doctrine, and put something cool together, and let me interview you after you do it. Tell me what you're up to. I should talk. I have people in my world that I could talk to about this. I need to start start using the people in my world for interviews a little more, and getting interesting folks that are smart, that know these kind of things on here. So, okay. So when we get back, we're heading towards the break. I don't really want to get too much started. I'm going to give you a little introduction to what we're going to talk about in the final segment. I have been reading, I'm trying to get myself together a little bit here, right? And one of the things I'm trying to get together is my health. And, some people say that, they'll joke, I have a face for radio. I don't have a face for radio. I have a face for television. I have a pretty nice face. My face and the face and the hair is about all I got, because the rest of me is a big fat guy. It's like, the face isn't that good either. The hair is spectacular, though. It's the only thing I got. The only thing I got going for me is a big, thick, curly set of hair, curly head of hair. That's physically the only thing I'm playing with, ladies and gentlemen. But so I'm trying to get myself together and lose some weight and get some inflammation down and strengthen some joints because I'm having some joint pain. And so I had recommended to me, and one of the big paleo guys. And so I had bought the book Body by Science, but I hadn't read it yet. And so I pulled out Body by Science on the old Kindle the other night and started reading it. And sure enough, up came a concept that I found and kind of marked on the internet with kind of the big five exercises. And it's got a ton of detail about some studies that I had only heard a little bit about. And basically that you get 90% of the bang for your buck by working out about once a week for about 15 minutes worth of actual like time under tension, you know. And that's fascinating. You get your first 90% of your returns come from that small of an amount. And as you increase doing more, you start the trade-off of like breaking stuff down and risking injury and stuff. So that reminded me of the concept of minimum effective dose that Tim Ferriss talks about. So when we get back, we're going to talk about those things, and I'm going to take it somewhere interesting, I think. So you're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Wavell. We'll be right back.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, and we are talking about minimum effective dose. So, as I said, I was reading Body by Science. The guys in Body by Science quote this study that shows that you get 90% of the bang for your buck from exercise in one workout a week. That anything you do beyond that, about 15 minutes of time of your muscle under tension. That's it. Strength training, not cardio, just five basic weight training exercises gives you. So if you see someone who works out with weights 2-3 times a week, swims a couple times a week, and you know, runs and all that stuff they're doing that isn't 15 minutes of very specific and intense strength training is getting them 10 to 15% bang for their buck, and they're tearing their body down and risking injury. And he talks about health and versus fitness and whether they're, and you know, we tend to think they're the same thing, but they're really not. That's why you see a lot of these athletes are really unhealthy. They start breaking down and having lots of injuries. And, you know, you see, guys that are, you know, the guy that founded the big jogging movement back in the 70s, like, dropped dead of a heart attack. You know, there's a long, long history of marathoners and daily runners dropping dead of heart attacks, right? Whether that's true or not, which I think it probably is, I mean, it's been pretty well documented that 15, 20 minutes of good, solid, really high intensity strength training gets you the most bang for your buck, right? But it reminded me of Tim Ferriss talking about a bunch of key concepts, and he takes that from medicine. Like, anytime you take a pill or something, there's always side effects from medicine and stuff. So you take this pill to help with this condition, but that pill is a little rough on your liver or whatever. So you want to take only as much of that pill as you need, the bare minimum that will get done what you needed to get done and no more. It's like, I have a CPAP machine because I have sleep apnea. I now have an APAP, which is an adjustable positive air pressure unit, and it senses how much resistance is being given it from the air going in, and it adjusts how much pressure it gives you. So you're only getting from moment to moment in each breath just what you need to keep you from having an apnea event, because anything over that can actually cause kind of a similar style of event where you you actually have a similar event where you kind of go into a lighter stage of sleep because of the excess pressure, right? So Tim Ferriss takes that concept, applies that concept to exercise, and he applies it to a lot of things, to meditation, to diet. It's like, what is the minimal you can do and get the biggest bang for your buck? Because we're all busy and we're all distractible. And what can you do? So the whole concept of minimal effective dose, right? Now, here's where this all comes together. So I've been, just trying to crawl back onto the GTD bandwagon with all this processing and just kind of like looking at all the outcomes and, you know, things that I want to be different, things I'm not happy with, you know, kind of actually naming them and writing them down on a list and calling them something, putting, even if they're real big problems that you maybe can't do anything directly about right now. I've had a couple of these in my life. I had a David Allen one time told me that here's a particular situation, David. And I told him about it and there's just nothing I can do about it right now. I mean, I can work on, there's like a bunch of sub projects to bigger projects that eventually will put me in a place where I can get that. But this thing is tugging on me. This thing is, I'm worried about this. And so I want to hide. And he said, and David told me, just put police tape around it and give it a name. It's just like, you know, like when you go up on a crime scene and yeah, it's carnage. It's an absolute mess. But they put the police tape up around the crime scene and they call it crime scene X49-376. It's like, you know, they give it a name. And so I started doing that on a couple things. And then it's actually kind of just naming some stuff and going, no, and just really acknowledging to myself by writing them down that I'm not happy with that. And I want that to be different. I want a different outcome in the world than the one that exists right now. I want reality to have a different shape than it has right now in this area. And so, you know, now David Allen has you look at each of these things and go, okay, so then he wants you to begin with the end in mind. Okay. And what do I mean by that? He just says, well, all these people start working on something and they don't define what done is. So they don't know what doing looks like. You have to know what done looks like. What's done? What is it that you're trying to make happen? How will you know what would be different in this world so that when you saw that you could check this off and, you know, it would, then you could say, okay, done. Right. So would it be if I lost 100 pounds, or if my body fat percentage was below this level, or it didn't matter how much fat I had on me, if my knees didn't hurt anymore, my ankles didn't hurt anymore, and I had plenty of energy, and I had good flexibility, and I felt good in my body, and I was healthy. You know, it's like, or maybe it's, you know, you want to be 185 pounds at less than 10% body fat with a VO2 max of such as, and maybe you want to get real, real exact on your performance levels. Or, and if you're an athlete or something, maybe you're like, okay, I want to be able, maybe you're a runner and you're like, okay, I want to break a 5-minute mile. I want to get below that 5-minute mile. I want to be here. I want to be there. I want to do this. But you define it in some way, right? You say, here's what done looks like. I have, you know, maybe it's like, take it outside of the world of, I was talking about a tiny coffee house. If I, you know, maybe I make that project and I go, okay, I want there to be a beautiful, heavily curated, really high value coffee house in a space less than 300 feet on a busy walkway with that two people working can handle, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 of business a day, or, you know, whatever. I mean, that's probably a little much for two people, but, you know, two people at a time, you know, and it's like, you know, you I want to set this up in a way where, and I want to be able to pay them a living wage and do this and have that and have it be cheap enough that people can come every day and afford to come, you know, and you just get all these parameters laid out and you go, okay, that's what I want to do. And you're like, okay. Now you start breaking down a bunch of projects inside of that. Right. You go, okay, well, I have to figure out that, you know, you have to design, you have to figure out what the math's going to look like. How much do we have to, what kind of margin do we need? You know, how much volume do you need to move to be able to, how much can rent be? How much can this be? How much can that be? And you figure out the parameters of what the project would look like. And so there's projects in there, you know, find a space for the project, you know, so that's a project, right? Because you can't just go find a space unless you're literally going to just leave and drive and look, and that's all you're going to do. But even then, it would, that wouldn't be an action, that would be an action that would say, get in car and drive around South Broadway and look for an appropriate open space under 300 square feet or whatever. You know, it's like, so you have to break these things down, right? To know what, you have to know what done looks like, then you have to know what doing looks like, and then you have to figure out what are the actual actions that you would do, right? Well, I just started thinking about something along those lines. So I looked at, like, you know, my health. I'm not happy with my level of focus. You know, kind of what I think about this show and what I want it to be and where I want it to go. And I kind of applied that. I looked at all these big obstacles and what would be the most, I think that Jason Womack, a former employee of David Allen, calls him MIT, is most important things. You know, what are the big obstacles? What are the big things? What are the moving parts on each of these outcomes that if you made that happen, if you made a change there, it would really open up a lot of movement on this outcome, right? And then, so I guess what I did today, kind of thinking about this, was you look at each of these things and you go, okay, what is the minimum effective dose? What would be the biggest bang for my buck? Okay, I need to start exercising. What would be the one I could do? I could start swimming. That takes a long time to go to the pool and change. You're going to do all that stuff. You know what I'm saying? So I decided that doing at least weekly the big five workouts in a high intensity strength training routine, that's going to be the minimum effective dose. That's going to give me 90% of my bang for the buck. But then it's like, okay, well, how do you apply that to your spiritual life? How do you apply that to kind of your kind of connection to purpose in this world and why you're here, or to maybe your emotional life or your psychological life? Maybe you have some addictions you're struggling with. You know, if you could fix one kind of like mental thing, one behavior, if you have some unwanted behaviors in your world, what would be the one that would unlock? Now, what would be the minimum effective dose to get that done? This is a completely unformed thought. This is just kind of what's been on my mind, is the concept of minimum effective dose. And so this is something I'm going to revisit a little bit. I'm throwing out ideas that I'm going to revisit today. So far we got minimum effective dose and the big moving parts. We've got Catholic social doctrine as a possible fire that different camps can get around, and it's going to snow. Well, I tell you what, this was, in fact, the counterposition today. Random, very random, but hopefully interesting. Oh, man. All right. Let's pull the plug. Cork on another episode. Thanks for putting up with me.